for her navel. Underneath is naught but billowing pale flesh. The medicops raise their eyebrows. The manager jumps back, raises both hands up to form a visual shield, protecting himself from the damaging input. "No, no, no," he says. YT shrugs, zips herself back up. She's not afraid. She's wearing a dentata. The manager handcuffs her to a cold water pipe. Second medicop removes his newer, more cybernetic brand of handcuffs, snaps them back onto his harness. First medicop leans her plank against the wall, just out of her reach. Manager kicks a rusty coffee can across the floor, caroming it expertly off her skin so she can go to the bathroom. "Where are you from?" YT asks.
"Tajikistan," he says.
"Tajik. She should have known.
Well, shit-can soccer must be your national pastime."
The manager doesn't get it. The medicops emit rote, shallow laughter. Papers are signed. Everyone else goes upstairs. On his way out the door, the manager turns off the lights. In Tajikistan, electricity is quite the big deal. YT is in the clink.
Amala quinza pantam cal nunca
cinco.
Seven. The black sun is as big as a couple of football fields laid side by side. The decor consists of black square tabletops hovering in the air. It would be pointless to draw in legs. Evenly spaced across the floor in a grid, like pixels. The only exception is in the middle, where the bar's four quadrants come together, 4 = 2². This part is occupied by a circular bar 16 meters across. Everything is matte black, which makes it a lot easier for the computer system to draw things in on top of it. No worries about filling in a complicated background. And that way, all attention can be focused on the avatars, which is the way people like it. It doesn't pay to have a nice avatar on the street, where it's so crowded and all the avatars merge and flow into one another. But the Black Sun is a much classier piece of software. In the Black Sun, avatars are not allowed to collide. Only so many people can be here at once, and they can't walk through each other. Everything is solid and opaque and realistic, and the clientele has a lot more class. No talking penises in here. The avatars look like real people. For the most part, so do the demons. Demon is an old piece of jargon from the Unix operating system, where it referred to a piece of low-level utility software, a fundamental part of the operating system. In the Black Sun, a demon is like an avatar, but it does not represent a human being. It's a robot that lives in the metaverse. A piece of software, a kind of spirit that inhabits the machine, usually with some particular role to carry out. The Black Sun has a number of demons that serve imaginary drinks to the patrons and run little errands for people. It even has bouncer demons that get rid of undesirables, grab their avatars and throw them out the door, applying certain basic principles of avatar physics. David has even enhanced the physics of the Black Sun to make it a little cartoonish so that particularly obnoxious people can be hit over the head with giant mallets or crushed under plummeting safes before they are ejected. This happens to people who are being disruptive, to anyone who is pestering or taping a celebrity, and to anyone who seems contagious. That is, if your personal computer is infected with viruses and attempts to spread them via the Black Sun, you had better keep one eye on the ceiling. Hiro mumbles the word, Big Board. This is the name of a piece of software he wrote, a powerful tool for a CIC stringer. It digs into the Black Sun's operating system, rifles it for information, and then throws up a flat square map in front of his face, giving him a quick overview of who's here and whom they're talking to. It's all unauthorized data that Hiro is not supposed to have. But Hiro is not some bimbo actor coming here to network. He is a hacker. If he wants some information, he steals it right out of the guts of the system. Gossip ex machina. Big Board shows him that David is ensconced in his usual place, a table in the hacker quadrant near the bar. The movie star quadrant has the usual scattering of sovereigns and wannabes. The rock star quadrant is very busy tonight. Hiro can see that a Nipponese rap star named Sushi K has stopped in for a visit. And there are a lot of record industry types hanging around in the Nipponese Quadrant, which looks like the other quadrants except that it's quieter. The tables are closer to the floor, and it's full of bowing and fluttering geisha demons. Many of these people probably belong to Sushike's retinue of managers, flacks, and lawyers. Hiro cuts across the hacker quadrant, headed for David's table. He recognizes many of the people in here, but as usual, he's surprised and disturbed by the number he doesn't recognize. All those sharp, perceptive 21-year-old faces. Software development, like professional sports, has a way of making 30-year-old men feel decrepit. Looking up the aisle toward David's table, he sees David talking to a black-and-white person. Despite her lack of color and shitty resolution, Hiro recognizes her by the way she folds her arms when she's talking, the way she tosses her hair when she's listening to David. Hiro's avatar stops moving and stares at her, adopting just the same facial expression with which he used to stare at this woman years ago. In reality, he reaches out with one hand, picks up his beer, takes a pull on the bottle, and lets it roll around in his mouth, a bundle of waves clashing inside a small space. Her name is Juanita Marquez. Hiro has known her ever since they were freshmen together at Berkeley, and they were in the same lab section in a freshman physics class. The first time he saw her, he formed an impression that did not change for many years. She was a dour, bookish, geeky type, who dressed like she was interviewing for a job as an accountant at a funeral parlor. At the same time, she had a flamethrower tongue that she would turn on people at the oddest times, usually in some grandiose, earth-scorching retaliation for a slight or breach of etiquette that none of the other freshmen had even perceived. It wasn't until a number of years later, when they both wound up working at Black Sun Systems, Inc., that he put the other half of the equation together. At the time, both of them were working on avatars. He was working on bodies, she was working on faces. She was the face department, because nobody thought that faces were all that important. They were just flesh-toned busts on top of the avatars. She was just in the process of proving them all desperately wrong. But at this phase, the all-male society of bitheads that made up the power structure of Black Sun Systems said that the face problem was trivial and superficial. It was, of course, nothing more than sexism, the especially virulent type espoused by male techies who sincerely believe that they're too smart to be sexists. That first impression back at the age of 17 was nothing more than that. The gut reaction of a post-adolescent army brat who had been on his own for about 3 weeks. His mind was good, but he only understood one or two things in the whole world. Samurai movies and the Macintosh. And he understood them far, far too well. It was a worldview with no room for someone like Juanita. There's a certain kind of small town that grows like a boil on the ass of every army base in the world. In a long series of such places, Hiro protagonist was speed-raised like a mutant hothouse orchid, flourishing under the glow of 1,000 buy-and-fly security spotlights. Hiro's father had joined the army in 1944 at the age of 16, and spent a year in the Pacific, most of it as a prisoner of war. Hiro was born when his father was in his late middle age. By that time, Dad could long since have quit and taken his pension, but he wouldn't have known what to do with himself outside of the service, and so he stayed in until they finally kicked him out in the late 80s. By the time Hiro made it out to Berkeley, he had lived in Wrightstown, New Jersey, Tacoma, Washington, Fayetteville, North Carolina, Hinesville, Georgia, Killeen, Texas, Grafenwöhr, Germany, Seoul, Korea, Ogden, Kansas, and Watertown, New York. All of these places were basically the same, with the same franchise ghettos, the same strip joints, and even the same people. He kept running into school chums he'd known years before, other army brats who happened to wind up at the same base at the same time. Their skins were different colors, but they all belonged to the same ethnic group, military. Black kids didn't talk like black kids. Asian kids didn't bust their asses to excel in school. White kids, by and large, didn't have any problem getting along with the black and Asian kids. And girls knew their place. They all had the same moms, with the same generous buttocks and stretchy slacks, and the same frosted and curling ironed hairdos, and they were all basically sweet and endearing and conforming, and if they happened to be smart, they went out of their way to hide it. So the first time Hiro saw Juanita, or any other girl like her, his perspectives were bent all out of shape. She had long, glossy black hair that had never been subjected to any chemical process other than regular shampooing. She didn't wear blue stuff on her eyelids. Her clothing was dark, tailored, restrained. And she didn't take shit from anyone, not even her professors, which seemed shrewish and threatening to him at the time. When he saw her again after an absence of several years, a period spent mostly in Japan, working among real grown-ups from a higher social class than he was used to, people of substance who wore real clothes and did real things with their lives, he was startled to realize that Juanita was an elegant, stylish knockout. He thought at first that she had undergone some kind of radical changes since their first year in college. But then he went back to visit his father in one of those army towns and ran into the high school prom queen. She had grown up shockingly fast into an overweight dame with loud hair and loud clothes who speed-read the tabloids at the checkout line in the commissary because she didn't have the spare money to buy them, who popped her gum and had two kids that she didn't have the energy or the foresight to discipline. Seeing this woman at the commissary, he finally went through a belated, dim-witted epiphany. Not a brilliant light shining down from heaven, more like the brown glimmer of a half-dead flashlight from the top of a stepladder. Juanita hadn't really changed much at all since those days, just grown into herself. It was he who had changed. Radically. He came into her office once, strictly on a business matter. Until this point, they had seen each other around the office a lot, but acted like they had never met before. But when he came into her office that day, she told him to close the door behind him, and she blacked out the screen on her computer and started twiddling a pencil between her hands and eyed him like a plate of day-old sushi. Behind her on the wall was an amateurish painting of an old lady, set in an ornate antique frame. It was the only decoration in Juanita's office. All the other hackers had color photographs of the space shuttle lifting off, or posters of the Starship Enterprise. "It's my late grandmother, may God have mercy on her soul," she said, watching him look at the painting. "My role model."
Why, was she a programmer?
She just looked at him over the rotating pencil like, how slow can a mammal be and still have respiratory functions? But instead of lowering the boom on him, she just gave a simple answer. "No." Then she gave a more complicated answer. "When I was 15 years old, I missed a period. My boyfriend and I were using a diaphragm, but I knew it was fallible. I was good at math. I had the failure rate memorized, burnt into my subconscious. Or maybe it was my conscious. I can never keep them straight. Anyway, I was terrified. Our family dog started treating me differently. Supposedly, they can smell a pregnant woman. Or a pregnant bitch, for that matter." By this point, Hiro's face was frozen in a wary, astonished position that Juanita later made extensive use of in her work. Because as she was talking to him, she was watching his face, analyzing the way the little muscles in his forehead pulled his brows up and made his eyes change shape. "My mother was clueless. My boyfriend was worse than clueless. In fact, I ditched him on the spot because it made me realize what an alien the guy was, like many members of your species." By this, she was referring to males. "Anyway, my grandmother came to visit," she continued, glancing back over her shoulder at the painting. "I avoided her until we all sat down for dinner, and then she figured out the whole situation in maybe 10 minutes, just by watching my face across the dinner table. I didn't say more than 10 words. Pass the tortillas. I don't know how my face conveyed that information, or what kind of internal wiring in my grandmother's mind enabled her to accomplish this incredible feat, to condense fact from the vapor of nuance." Condense fact from the vapor of nuance. Hiro has never forgotten the sound of her speaking those words. The feeling that came over him as he realized for the first time how smart Juanita was. She continued,
I didn't even really appreciate all of this until about 10 years later as a grad student trying to build a user interface that would convey a lot of data very quickly for one of these baby killer grants. This was her term for anything related to the Defense Department. I was coming up with all kinds of elaborate technical fixes, like trying to implant electrodes directly into the brain. Then I remembered my grandmother and realized, my God, the human mind can absorb and process an incredible amount of information if it comes in the right format, the right interface, if you put the right face on it. Want some coffee? Then he had an alarming thought. What had he been like back in college? How much of an asshole had he been? Had he left Juanita with a bad impression? Another young man would have worried about it in silence, but Hiro has never been restrained by thinking about things too hard, and so he asked her out for dinner and, after having a couple of drinks, she drank club sodas, just popped the question. Do you think I'm an asshole? She laughed. He smiled, believing that he had come up with a good, endearing, flirtatious bit of patter. He did not realize until a couple of years later that this question was, in effect, the cornerstone of their relationship. Did Juanita think that Hiro was an asshole? He always had some reason to think that the answer was yes, but 9 times out of 10 she insisted the answer was no. It made for some great arguments and some great sex, some dramatic fallings out and some passionate reconciliations, but in the end, the wildness was just too much for them. They were exhausted by work, and they backed away from each other. He was emotionally worn out from wondering what she really thought of him, and confused by the fact that he cared so deeply about her opinion. And she, maybe, was beginning to think that if Hiro was so convinced in his own mind that he was unworthy of her, maybe he knew something she didn't. Hiro would have chalked it all up to class differences, except that her parents lived in a house in Mexicali with a dirt floor, and his father made more money than many college professors. But the class idea still held sway in mind, because class is more than income. It has to do with knowing where you stand in a web of social relationships. Juanita and her folks knew where they stood with a certitude that bordered on dementia. Hiro never knew. His father was a sergeant major. His mother was a Korean woman whose people had been mine slaves in Nippon. And Hiro didn't know whether he was black or Asian or just plain army. Whether he was rich or poor, educated or ignorant, talented or lucky. He didn't even have a part of the country to call home until he moved to California, which is about as specific as saying that you live in the Northern Hemisphere. In the end, it was probably his general disorientation that did them in. After the breakup, Hiro went out with a long succession of essentially bimbos who, unlike Juanita, were impressed that he worked for a high-tech Silicon Valley firm. More recently, he has had to go searching for women who are even easier to impress. Juanita went celibate for a while and then started going out with David and eventually got married to him. David had no doubts whatsoever about his standing in the world. His folks were Russian Jews from Brooklyn and had lived in the same brownstone for 70 years after coming from a village in Latvia, where they had lived for 500 years. With the Torah on his lap, he could trace his bloodlines all the way back to Adam and Eve. He was an only child who had always been first in his class in everything, and when he got his master's in computer science from Stanford, he went out and started his own company with about as much fuss as Hiro's dad used to exhibit in renting out a new P.O. box when they moved. Then he got rich, and now he runs the Black Sun. David has always been certain of everything, even when he's totally wrong. Which is why Hiro quit his job at Black Sun Systems, despite the promise of future riches, and why Juanita divorced David 2 years after she married him. Hiro did not attend Juanita and David's wedding. He was languishing in jail, into which he had been thrown a few hours before the rehearsal. He had been found in Golden Gate Park, lovesick, wearing nothing but a thong, taking long pulls from a jumbo bottle of Courvoisier, and practicing kendo attacks with a genuine samurai sword, floating across the grass on powerfully muscled thighs to slice other picnickers' frisbees and baseballs in twain. Catching a long fly ball with the edge of your blade, neatly halving it like a grapefruit, is not an insignificant feat.
The only drawback is that the owners of the baseball may misinterpret your intentions and summon the police. He got out of it by paying for all the baseballs and frisbees. But since that episode, he has never even bothered to ask Juanita whether or not she thinks he's an asshole. Even Hiro knows the answer now. Since then, they've gone very different ways. In the early years of the Black Sun Project, the only way the hackers ever got paid was by issuing stock to themselves. Hiro tended to sell his off almost as quickly as he got it. Juanita didn't. Now she's rich, and he isn't. It would be easy to say that Hiro is a stupid investor and Juanita a smart one, but the facts are a little more complicated than that. Juanita put her eggs in one basket, keeping all her money in Black Sun stock. As it turns out, she made a lot of money that way, but she could have gone broke, too. And Hiro didn't have a lot of choice in some ways. When his father got sick, the Army and the VA took care of most of his medical bills, but they ran into a lot of expenses anyway. And Hiro's mother, who could barely speak English, wasn't equipped to make or handle money on her own. When Hiro's father died, he cashed in all of his Black Sun stock to put Mom in a nice community in Korea. She loves it there, goes golfing every day. He could have kept his money in the Black Sun and made $10 million about a year later when it went public, but his mother would have been a street person. So when his mother visits him in the metaverse, looking tan and happy in her golfing duds, Hiro views that as his personal fortune. It won't pay the rent, but that's okay. When you live in a shithole, there's always the metaverse. And in the metaverse, Hiro protagonist is a warrior prince. Eight. His tongue is stinging. He realizes that, back in reality, he has forgotten to swallow his beer. It's ironic that Juanita has come into this place in a low-tech black-and-white avatar. She was the one who figured out a way to make Avatar show something close to real emotion. That is a fact Hiro has never forgotten, because she did most of her work when they were together. And whenever an Avatar looks surprised or angry or passionate in the metaverse, he sees an echo of himself or Juanita. The Adam and Eve of the metaverse makes it hard to forget. Shortly after Juanita and David got divorced, the Black Sun really took off. And once they got done counting their money, marketing the spin-offs, soaking up the adulation of others in the hacker community, they all came to the realization that what made this place a success was not the collision avoidance algorithms or the bouncer demons or any of that other stuff. It was Juanita's faces. Just ask the businessmen in the Nipponese Quadrant. They come here to talk turkey with suits from around the world, and they consider it just as good as a face-to-face. They more or less ignore what is being said. A lot gets lost in translation, after all. They pay attention to the facial expressions and body language of the people they are talking to. And that's how they know what's going on inside a person's head. By condensing fact from the vapor of nuance. Juanita refused to analyze this process, insisted that it was something ineffable, something you couldn't explain with words. A radical rosary-toting Catholic, she has no problem with that kind of thing. But the bitheads didn't like it, said it was irrational mysticism. So she quit and took a job with some Nipponese company. They don't have any problem with irrational mysticism, as long as it makes money. But Juanita never comes to the Black Sun anymore. Partly she's pissed at David and the other hackers who never appreciated her work, but she has also decided that the whole thing is bogus. That no matter how good it is, the metaverse is distorting the way people talk to each other, and she wants no such distortion in her relationships. David notices Hiro, indicates with a flick of his eyes that this is not a good time. Normally such subtle gestures are lost in the system's noise, but David has a very good personal computer, and Juanita helped design his avatar, so the message comes through like a shot fired into the ceiling. Hiro turns away, saunters around the big circular bar in a slow orbit. Most of the 64 bar stools are filled with lower-level industry people, getting together in twos and threes, doing what they do best, gossip and intrigue.
So I get together with the director for a story conference. He's got this beach house.
Incredible?
Don't get me started.
I heard Debbie was there for a party when Frank and Mitzi owned it.
Anyway, there's this scene, early, where the main character wakes up in a dumpster. The idea is to show how, you know, despondent he is.
That crazy energy.
Exactly.
Fabulous.
I like it. Well, he wants to replace it with a scene where the guy is out in the desert with a bazooka, blowing up old cars in an abandoned junkyard.
You're kidding.
So we're sitting there on his fucking patio over the beach, and he's going like, woom, woom, imitating this goddamn bazooka. He's thrilled by the idea. I mean, this is a man who wants to put a bazooka in a movie. So I think I talked him out of it.
Nice scene, but you're right. A bazooka doesn't do the same thing as a dumpster.
Hiro pauses long enough to get this down, then keeps walking. He mumbles Big Board again, recalls the magic map, pinpoints his own location, and then reads off the name of this nearby screenwriter. Later on, he can do a search of industry publications to find out what script this guy is working on, hence the name of this mystery director with a fetish for bazookas. Since this whole conversation has come to him via his computer, he's just taken an audio tape of the whole thing. Later, he can process it to disguise the voices, then upload it to the library, cross-referenced under the director's name. 100 struggling screenwriters will call this conversation up, listen to it over and over until they got it memorized, paying Hiro for the privilege, and within a few weeks, bazooka scripts will flood the director's office. Whoom! The Rockstar Quadrant is almost too bright to look at. Rockstar avatars have the hairdos that rockstars can only wear in their dreams. Hiro scans it briefly to see if any of his friends are in there, but it's mostly parasites and has-beens. Most of the people Hiro knows are will-bes or wannabes. The movie star quadrant is easier to look at. Actors love to come here because in the black sun, they always look as good as they do in the movies. And unlike a bar or club in reality, they can get into this place without physically having to leave their mansion, hotel suite, ski lodge, private airline cabin, or whatever. They can strut their stuff and visit with their friends without any exposure to kidnappers, paparazzi, script flingers, assassins, ex-spouses, autograph brokers, process servers, psycho fans, marriage proposals, or gossip columnists. He gets up off the bar stool and resumes his slow orbit, scanning the Nipponese quadrant. It's a lot of guys in suits, as usual. Some of them are talking to gringos from the industry, and a large part of the quadrant, in the back corner, has been screened off by a temporary partition. Big Board again. Hiro figures out which tables are behind the partition, starts reading off the names. The only one he recognizes immediately is an American, L. Bob Reif, the cable television monopolist. A very big name to the industry, though he's rarely seen. He seems to be meeting with a whole raft of big Nipponese honchos. Hiro has his computer memorize their names so that later he can check them against the CIC database and find out who they are. It has the look of a big and important meeting. Secret Agent Hiro, how are you doing? Hiro turns around. Juanita is right behind him, standing out in her black and white avatar, looking good anyway. How are you? She asks.
Fine, how are you?
Great. I hope you don't mind talking to me in this ugly facts of life avatar.
Juanita, I would rather look at a facts of you than most other women in the flesh.
Thanks, you sly bastard. It's been a long time since we've talked, she observes, as though there's something remarkable about this. Something's going on. I hope you're not going to mess around with Snow Crash, she says. David won't listen to me.
What am I, a model of self-restraint? I'm exactly the kind of guy who would mess around with it.
I know you better than that. You're impulsive, but you're very clever. You have those sword-fighting reflexes.
What does that have to do with drug abuse?
It means you can see bad things coming and deflect them. It's an instinct, not a learned thing. As soon as you turned around and saw me, that look came over your face. Like, what's going on? What the hell is Juanita up to?
I didn't think you talked to people in the metaverse.
I do if I want to get through to someone in a hurry, she says. And I'll always talk to you.
Why me?
You know, because of us. Remember, because of our relationship when I was writing this thing? You and I are the only two people who can ever have an honest conversation in the metaverse.
You're just the same mystical crank you always were, he says, smiling so as to make this a charming statement.
You can't imagine how mystical and cranky I am now, Hero.
How mystical and cranky are you?
She eyes him warily. Exactly the same way she did when he came into her office years ago. It comes into his mind to wonder why she is always so alert in his presence. In college, he used to think that she was afraid of his intellect, but he's known for years that this is the last of her worries. At Black Sun Systems, he figured that it was just typical female guardedness. Juanita was afraid he was trying to get her into the sack. But this, too, is pretty much out of the question. At this late date in his romantic career, he's just canny enough to come up with a new theory. She's being careful because she likes him. She likes him in spite of herself. He's exactly the kind of tempting but utterly wrong romantic choice that a smart girl like Juanita must learn to avoid. That's definitely it. There's something to be said for getting older. By way of answering his question, she says, I have an associate I'd like you to meet. A gentleman and a scholar named Lagos. He's a fascinating guy to talk to.
Is he your boyfriend?
She thinks this one over rather than lashing out instantaneously. My behavior at the Black Sun, to the contrary, I don't fuck every male I work with. And even if I did, Lagos is out of the question.
Not your type?
Not by a long shot.
What is your type, anyway?
Old, rich, unimaginative blondes with steady careers. This one almost slips by him. Then he catches it.
Well, I could dye my hair, and I'll get old eventually.
She actually laughs. It's a tension-releasing kind of outburst. Believe me, Hero, I'm the last person you want to be involved with at this point.
Is this part of your church thing? He asks.
Juanita has been using her excess money to start her own branch of the Catholic Church. She considers herself a missionary to the intelligent atheists of the world. Don't be condescending, she says. That's exactly the attitude I'm fighting. Religion is not for simpletons.
Sorry. This is unfair, you know. You can read every expression on my face, and I'm looking at you through a fucking blizzard.
It's definitely related to religion, she says. But this is so complex, and your background in that area is so deficient, I don't know where to begin.
Hey, I went to church every week in high school. I sang in the choir.
I know. That's exactly the problem. 99% of everything that goes on in most Christian churches has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual religion. Intelligent people all notice this sooner or later, and they conclude that the entire 100% is bullshit, which is why atheism is connected with being intelligent in people's minds.
So, none of that stuff I learned in church has anything to do with what you're talking about?
Juanita thinks for a while, eyeing him. Then she pulls a hypercard out of her pocket. Here, take this. As Hero pulls it from her hand, the hypercard changes from a jittery two-dimensional figment into a realistic cream-colored, finely textured piece of stationery. Printed across its face in glossy black ink is a pair of words. The first word, B-A-B-E-L, Babel. The second word, Infocalypse. Nine. The world freezes and grows dim for a second. The Black Sun loses its smooth animation and begins to move in fuzzy stop action. Clearly, his computer has just taken a major hit. All of its circuits are busy processing a huge bolus of data, the contents of the hypercard, and don't have time to redraw the image of the Black Sun in its full, breathtaking fidelity.
Holy shit, he says, when the Black Sun pops back into full animation again. What the hell is in this card? You must have half the library in here.
And a librarian to boot, Juanita says, to help you sort through it. And lots of videotapes of L. Bob Reif,
which accounts for most of the bites.
Well, I'll try to have a look at it, he says dubiously.
Do. Unlike David, you're just smart enough to benefit from this. And in the meantime, stay away from Raven. And stay away from Snow Crash, okay?
Who's Raven? He asks.
But Juanita is already on her way out the door. The fancy avatars all turn around to watch her as she goes past them. The movie stars give her drop-dead looks, and the hackers purse their lips and stare reverently. Hero orbits back around to the hacker quadrant. David's shuffling hypercards around on his table. Business stats in the Black Sun, film and video clips, hunks of software, scrawled telephone numbers.
There's a little blip in the operating system that hits me right in the gut every time you come in the door, David says. I always have this premonition that the Black Sun is headed for a crash.
Must be Big Board, Hero says. It has one routine that patches some of the traps in low memory for a moment.
Ah, that's it. Please, please, throw that thing away, David says.
What, Big Board?
Yeah, it was totally rad at one point, but now it's like trying to work on a fusion reactor with a stone axe.
Thanks.
I'll give you all the headers you need if you want to update it to something a little less dangerous, David says. I wasn't impugning your abilities. I'm just saying you need to keep up with the times.
It's fucking hard, Hero says. There's no place for a freelance hacker anymore. You have to have a big corporation behind you.
I'm aware of that, and I'm aware that you can't stand to work for a big corporation. That's why I'm saying I'll give you the stuff you need. You're always a part of the Black Sun to me, Hero, even since we parted ways.
It is classic David. He's talking with his heart again, bypassing his head. If David weren't a hacker, Hero would despair of his ever having enough brains to do anything.
Let's talk about something else, Hero says. Was I just hallucinating, or are you and Juanita on speaking terms again?
David gives him an indulgent smile. He has been very kind to Hero ever since the conversation several years back. It was a conversation that started out as a friendly chat over beer and oysters between a couple of longtime comrades in arms. It was not until three-quarters of the way through the conversation that it dawned on Hero that he was, in fact, being fired at this very moment. Since the conversation, David has been known to feed Hero useful bits of intel and gossip from time to time.
Fishing for something useful? David asks knowingly.
Like many bitheads, David is utterly guileless, but at times like this, he thinks he's the reincarnation of Machiavelli.
I got news for you, man, Hero says. Most of the stuff you give me, I never put into the library.
Why not? Hell, I give you all my best gossip. I thought you were making money off that stuff.
I just can't stand it, Hero says, taking parts of my private conversations and whoring them out. Why do you think I'm broke?
There's another thing he doesn't mention, which is that he's always considered himself to be David's equal, and he can't stand the idea of feeding off David's little crumbs and tidbits like a dog curled up under his table.
I was glad to see Juanita come in here, even as a black and white, David says. For her not to use the Black Sun. It's like Alexander Graham Bell refusing to use the telephone.
Why did she come in tonight?
Something's bugging her, David says. She wanted to know if I'd seen certain people on the street.
Anyone in particular?
She's worried about a really large guy with long black hair, David says, peddling something called, get this, Snow Crash.
Has she tried the library?
Yeah, I assume so anyway.
Have you seen this guy?
Oh, yeah. It's not hard to find him, David says. He's right outside the door. I got this from him.
David scans the table, picks up one of the hypercards, and shows it to Hero. Snow Crash. Tear this card in half to release your free sample.
David, Hero says, I can't believe you took a hypercard from a black and white person.
David laughs.
This is not the old days, my friend. I've got so much antiviral medicine in my system that nothing can get through. I get so much contaminated shit from all the hackers who come through here. It's like working in a plague ward. So I'm not afraid of whatever's in this hypercard.
Well, In that case, I'm curious, Hiro says.
Yeah, me too, David laughs.
It's probably something very disappointing.
Probably an animercial, David agrees. Think I should do it?
Yeah, go for it. It's not every day you get to try out a new drug, Hiro says.
Well, you can try one every day if you want to, David says. But it's not every day you find one that can't hurt you.
He picks up the HyperCard and tears it in half. For a second, nothing happens.
I'm waiting, David says.
An avatar materializes on the table in front of David, starting out ghostly and transparent, gradually becoming solid and three-dimensional. It's a really trite effect. Hiro and David are already laughing. The avatar is a stark naked Brandy. It doesn't even look like the standard Brandy. This looks like one of the cheap Taiwanese Brandy knockoffs. Clearly, it's just a demon. She's holding a pair of tubes in her hands, about the size of paper towel rolls. David is leaning back in his chair, enjoying this. There's something hilariously tawdry about the entire scene. The Brandy leans forward, beckoning David toward her. David leans into her face, grinning broadly. She puts her crude, ruby-red lips up by his ear and mumbles something that Hiro can't hear. When she leans back away from David, his face has changed. He looks dazed and expressionless. Maybe David really looks that way. Maybe Snow Crash has messed up his avatar somehow so that it's no longer tracking David's true facial expressions. But he's staring straight ahead, eyes frozen in their sockets. The Brandy holds the pair of tubes up in front of David's immobilized face and spreads them apart. It's actually a scroll. She's unrolling it right in front of David's face, spreading it apart like a flat two-dimensional screen in front of his eyes. David's paralyzed face has taken on a bluish tinge as it reflects light coming out of the scroll. Hiro walks around the table to look. He gets a brief glimpse of the scroll before the Brandy snaps it shut again. It is a living wall of light, like a flexible, flat-screened television set, and it's not showing anything at all. Just static. White noise. Snow. Then she's gone, leaving no trace behind. Desultory sarcastic applause sounds from a few tables in the hacker quadrant. David's back to normal, wearing a grin that's part snide and part embarrassed.
What was it? Hiro says. I just glimpsed some snow at the very end.
You saw the whole thing, David says. A fixed pattern of black and white pixels, fairly high resolution. Just a few hundred thousand ones and zeros for me to look at.
So in other words, someone just exposed your optic nerve to, what, maybe 100,000 bytes of information, Hiro says.
Noise is more like it.
Well, all information looks like noise until you break the code, Hiro says.
Why would anyone show me information in binary code? I'm not a computer. I can't read a bitmap.
Relax, David. I'm just shitting you, Hiro says.
You know what it was? You know how hackers are always trying to show me samples of their work?
Yeah.
Some hacker came up with a scheme to show me his stuff. And everything worked fine until the moment the Brandy opened the scroll. But his code was buggy, and it snow crashed at the wrong moment. So instead of seeing his output, all I saw was snow.
Then why did he call the thing Snow Crash?
Gallows humor. He knew it was buggy.
What did the Brandy whisper in your ear?
Some language I didn't recognize, David says. Just a bunch of babble.
Babble. Babble. Afterward, you look sort of stunned.
David looks resentful.
I wasn't stunned. I just found the whole experience so weird. I guess I just was taken aback for a second.
Hiro is giving him an extremely dubious look. David notices it and stands up.
Wanna go see what your competitors in Nippon are up to?
What competitors?
You used to design avatars for Rackstars, right?
Still do.
Well, Sushi K is here tonight.
Oh, yeah. The hairdo the size of a galaxy.
You can see the rays from here, David says, waving toward the next quadrant. But I want to see the whole getup.
It does look as though the sun is rising somewhere in the middle of the Rockstar quadrant. Above the heads of the milling avatars, Hiro can see a fan of orange beams radiating outward from some point in the middle of the crowd. It keeps moving, turning around, shaking from side to side, and the whole universe seems to move with it. On the street, the full radiance of Sushi K's rising sun hairdo is suppressed by the height and width regulations, but David allows free expression inside the black sun, so the orange rays extend all the way to the property lines.
I wonder if anyone's told him yet that the Americans won't buy rap music from a Japanese person, Hiro says as they stroll over there.
Maybe you should tell him, David suggests. Charge him for the service. He's in L.A. right now, you know.
Probably staying in a hotel full of bootlickers telling him what a big star he's going to be. He needs to be exposed to some actual biomass.
They inject themselves into a stream of traffic, winding a narrow channel through a rift in the crowd.
Biomass, David says.
A body of living stuff. It's an ecology term. If you take an acre of rainforest or a cubic mile of ocean or a square block of Compton and strain out all the non-living stuff, dirt and water, you get the biomass.
David, ever the bithead, says,
I do not understand.
His voice sounds funny. There's a lot of white noise creeping into his audio.
Industry expression, Hiro says. The industry feeds off the human biomass of America, like a whale straining krill from the sea.
Hiro wedges himself between a couple of Nipponese businessmen. One is wearing uniform blue, but the other is a neo-traditional, wearing a dark kimono. And like Hiro, he's wearing two swords, the long katana on his left hip and the one-handed wakizashi stuck diagonally in his waistband. He and Hiro glance cursorily at each other's armaments. Then Hiro looks away and pretends not to notice, while the neo-traditional is freezing solid except for the corners of his mouth, which are curling downward. Hiro has seen this kind of thing before. He knows he's about to get into a fight. People are moving out of the way. Something big and inexorable is plunging through the crowd, shoving avatars this way and that. Only one thing has the ability to shove people around like that inside the black sun, and that's a bouncer demon. As they get closer, Hiro sees that it's a whole flying wedge of them, gorillas in tuxedos, real gorillas, and they seem to be headed toward Hiro. He tries to back away, but he quickly runs into something. Looks like Big Board finally got him in trouble. He's on his way out of the bar.
David, Hiro says, call them off, man. I'll stop using it.
All of the people in his vicinity are staring over Hiro's shoulder, their faces illuminated by a stew of brilliant colored lights. Hiro turns around to look at David, but David's not there anymore. Instead of David, there's just a jittering cloud of bad digital karma. It's so bright and fast and meaningless that it hurts to look at. It flashes back and forth from color to black and white, and when it's in color, it rolls wildly around the color wheel as though being strafed with high-powered disco lights. And it's not staying within its own body space. Hair-thin pixel lines keep shooting off to one side, passing all the way across the black sun and out through the wall. It is not so much an organized body as it is a centrifugal cloud of lines and polygons whose center cannot hold, throwing bright bits of body shrapnel all over the room, interfering with people's avatars, flickering and disappearing. The gorillas don't mind. They shove their long, furry fingers into the midst of the disintegrating cloud and latch onto it somehow and carry it past Hiro toward the exit. Hiro looks down as it goes past him and sees what looks very much like David's face as viewed through a pile of shattered glass. It's just a momentary glimpse. Then the avatar is gone, expertly drop-kicked out the front door, soaring out over the street in a long, flat arc that takes it over the horizon. Hiro looks up the aisle to see David's table, empty, surrounded by stunned hackers. Some of them are shocked. Some are trying to stifle grins. David Meyer, supreme hacker overlord, founding father of the Metaverse Protocol, creator and proprietor of the world-famous Black Sun, has just suffered a system crash. He's been thrown out of his own bar by his own demons. Ten. About the second or third thing they learned how to do when studying to become couriers was how to shiv open a pair of handcuffs. Handcuffs are not intended as long-term restraint devices. Millions of clink franchisees to the contrary. And the long-time status of skateboarders as an oppressed ethnic group means that, by now, all of them are escape artists of some degree. First things first, YT has many a thing hanging off her uniform. The uniform has 100 pockets, big flat pockets for deliveries, and eensy narrow pockets for gear, pockets sewn into sleeves, thighs, shins. The equipment stuck into these multifarious pockets tends to be small, tricky, lightweight. Pens, markers, pen lights, pen knives, lockpicks, barcode scanners, flares, screwdrivers, liquid knuckles, Bundy stunners, and light sticks. A calculator stuck upside down to her right thigh, doubling as a taxi meter and a stopwatch. On the other thigh is a personal phone. As the manager is locking the door upstairs, it begins to ring. YT off-hooks it with her free hand. It's her mother.
Hi, Mom. Fine, how are you? I'm at Tracy's house. Yeah, we went to the Metaverse. We were just fooling around at this arcade on the street. Pretty bumpin'. Yes, I used a nice avatar. Nah. Tracy's mom said she'd give me a ride home later. But we might stop off at the Joyride on Victory for a while, okay? Okay, well, sleep tight, Mom. I will. I love you too. See you later.
She punches the flash button, killing the chat with Mom and giving her a fresh dial tone in the space of about half a second.
Roadkill, she says.
The telephone remembers and dials Roadkill's number. Roaring sounds. This is the sound of air peeling over the microphone of Roadkill's personal phone at some terrifying velocity. Also the competing whooshes of many vehicles' tires on pavement, broken by chuckhole percussion, sounds like the crumbling Ventura.
Yo, YT, Roadkill says. Sup? Sup with you?
Surfing the Tura. Sup with you?
Maxing the clink.
Whoa, who popped you?
Met a cops. Affixed me to the gate of white columns with a loogie gun.
Whoa, how very. When you leaving?
Soon. Can you swing by and give me a hand?
What do you mean?
Men. You know, give me a hand. You're my boyfriend? She says, speaking very simply and plainly. If I get popped, you're supposed to come around and help bust me out.
Isn't everyone supposed to know this stuff? Don't parents teach their kids anything anymore?
Well, where are you?
Buy and fly number 501,762.
I'm on my way to Bernie with a super ultra.
As in San Bernardino. As in super ultra high priority delivery. As in, you're out of luck.
Okay, thanks for nothing.
Sorry.
Surfing safety,
YT says in the traditional sarcastic sign-off.
Keep breathing,
Roadkill says. The roaring noise snaps off. What a jerk. Next date, he's really going to have to grovel. But in the meantime, there's one other person who owes her one. The only problem is that he might be a spaz, but it's worth a try.
Hello?
He says into his personal phone. He's breathing hard, and a couple of sirens are dueling in the background.
Hero protagonist?
Yeah. Who's this?
YT, where are you?
In the parking lot of a Safeway on Oahu, he says.
And he's telling the truth. In the background, she can hear the shopping carts performing their clashy anal copulations.
I'm kind of busy now, Whitey. But what can I do for you?
It's YT, she says. And you can help bust me out of the clink.
She gives him the details.
How long ago did he put you there?
10 minutes.
Okay. The 3-ring binder for clink franchises states that the manager is supposed to check on the detainee half an hour after admission.
How do you know this stuff? She says accusingly.
Use your imagination. As soon as the manager pulls his half-hour check, wait for another 5 minutes and then make your move. I'll try to give you a hand, okay?
Got it.
At half an hour on the dot, she hears the back door being unlocked. The lights come on. Her night vision saves her from racking eyeball pains. The manager thunks down a couple of steps, glares at her for rather a long time. The manager clearly is tempted. That momentary glimpse of flesh has been ricocheting around in his brain for half an hour. He is racking his mind with vast cosmological dilemmas. Whitey hopes that he does not try anything because the dentata's effects can be unpredictable. Make up your fucking mind, she says. It works. This fresh burst of culture shock rattles the jeek out of his ethical conundrum. He gives YT a disapproving glower. She, after all, forced him to be attracted to her, forced him to get horny, made his head swim. She didn't have to get arrested, did she? And so on top of everything else, he's angry with her, as if he has a right to be. This is the gender that invented the polio vaccine? He turns, goes back up the steps, kills the light, locks the door. She notes the time, sets her alarm watch for 5 minutes from now. The only North American who actually knows how to set the alarm on her digital wristwatch. Pulls her shiv kit from one of the narrow pockets on her sleeve. She also hauls out a light stick and snaps it so she can see what's up. She finds one piece of narrow, flat spring steel, slides it up into the manacle's innards, depresses the spring-loaded pawl. The cuff, formerly a one-way ratchet that could only get tighter, springs loose from the cold water pipe. She could take it off her wrist, but she has decided she likes the look of it. She cuffs the loose manacle onto her wrist, right next to the other one, forming a double bracelet. The kind of thing her mom used to do, back when she was a punk. The steel door is locked, but by-and-fly safety regs mandate an emergency exit from the basement in case of fire. Here, it's a basement window with Mondo bars and a big red multilingual fire alarm bolted onto it. The red looks black in the green glow of the light stick. She reads the instructions that are in English, runs through it once or twice in her mind, then waits for the alarm to go off. She whiles away the time by reading the instructions in all the other languages, wondering which is which. It all looks like taxi lingo to YT. The window is almost too grungy to see through, but she sees something black walking past it. Hero. About 10 seconds later, her wristwatch goes off. She punches the emergency exit. The bell rings. The bars are trickier than she thought. Good thing it's not a real fire, but eventually she gets them open. She throws her plank outside onto the parking lot, drags her body through just as she hears the rear door being unlocked. By the time the three-ringer has found that all-important light switch, she is banking a sharp turn into the front lot, which has turned into a Jeek festival. Every Jeek in Southern Cal is here, it seems, driving their giant wrecked taxicabs with alien livestock in the backseat, reeking of incense and sloshing neon-hued airwicks. They have set up a giant 8-tubed hookah on the trunk of one of the cabs and are slurping up great mountain man lungfuls of choking smoke. And they're all staring at hero protagonist, who is just staring back at them. Everyone in the parking lot looks completely astounded. He must have made his approach from the rear, didn't realize that the front lot was full of Jeeks. Whatever he was planning isn't going to work. The plan is screwed. The manager comes running around from the back of the by-and-fly, sounding a blood-curdling taxilinga toxin. He's got missile lock on YT's ass. But the Jeeks around the hookah don't care about YT. They've got missile lock on Hero. They carefully hang the ornate silver nozzles on a rack built into the neck of the megabong. Then they start moving toward him, reaching into the folds of their robes, the inner pockets of their windbreakers. YT is distracted by a sharp hissing noise. Her eyes glance back at Hero, and she sees that he has withdrawn a 3-foot curved sword from a scabbard, which she did not notice before. He has dropped into a squat. The blade of the sword glitters painfully under the killer security lights of the by-and-fly. How sweet! It would be an understatement to say that the hookah boys are taken aback, but they're not scared so much as they are confused. Almost undoubtedly, most of them have guns. So why is this guy trying to bother them with a sword? She remembers that one of the multiple professions on Hero's business card is greatest sword fighter in the world. Can he really take out a whole clan of armed Jeeks? The manager's hand clenches her upper arm, like this is really going to stop her. She reaches across her body with the other hand and lets him have it with a brief squirt of liquid knuckles. He makes a muffled, distant grunt. His head snaps back. He lets go of her arm and staggers back wildly until he sprawls against another taxi, jamming the heels of both hands into his eye sockets. Wait a sec. There's nobody in that particular taxi, but she can see a two-foot